This is VOA News by remote. I'm Tommy McKean. At least three rockets landed near Erbil International Airport in the semi-autonomous Kurdistan region of Iraq, killing one, wounding five people, according to a coalition spokesperson. Colonel Wayne Morato on Twitter said initial reports that indirect fire landed on coalition forces in Erbil. There was one civilian contractor killed, five civilian contractors injured, and one U.S. service member injured. A statement from the Kurdish Interior Ministry said a number of rockets were fired towards Erbil and its outskirts around 9:30 p.m. local time, and some people were wounded, but it offered no further details. It was not immediately clear if a U.S. military base housing U.S. troops near the airport was the target of the attack. Hundreds of anti-coup protesters gathered at a junction in Yangon Tuesday. It's a key crossroad from which groups fanned out to other points, including the embassies of the United States and China. They held banners demanding the release of the deposed leader Aung San Suu Kyi and CDM signs. CDM refers to the civil disobedience movement that has seen doctors, engineers, and others in Myanmar refuse to work until the military release elected political leaders and return the country to civilian rule. Some laid on the ground in a silent protest with their eyes covered. The World Health Organization has granted an emergency authorization to the coronavirus vaccine made by AstraZeneca and Oxford University. The move should allow the UN Health Agency's partners to ship millions of doses to countries as part of a UN-backed program to tame the pandemic. The WHO said it was authorizing the AstraZeneca vaccines made by an Indian and South Korea AstraZeneca Corporation. This is VOA News. A foundation based at Tel Aviv University honors the U.S. top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci. We get more from AP correspondent Mike Rossia.
Dr. Anthony Fauci has won a $1 million Israeli prize for his work during the coronavirus pandemic. The Dan David Foundation did not mention former President Donald Trump, but it credited Fauci for courageously defending science in the face of uninformed opposition during the challenging COVID crisis. Last month, after the change in administrations, Fauci admitted
there were things that were said, be it regarding things like hydroxychloroquine and other things like that, that really was uncomfortable because they were not based on scientific fact.
Fauci won the Dan David Foundation Prize for achievement in the present in the field of public health. I'm Mike Rossia.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo continues to take criticism for the lethal path the coronavirus took through New York's nursing homes, but he is insisting that the state did not cover up details. AP's Ben Thomas.
There was a delay.
Governor Andrew Cuomo acknowledged officials should have moved faster to release information. The state has been forced to acknowledge its count of nursing home deaths excluded thousands of residents who perished after being taken to hospitals.
We didn't answer every question, so it allowed the void to be created. The void begets disinformation. The disinformation begets pain of people. I take responsibility for that.
But at a news conference, Cuomo insisted
all the deaths in the nursing homes and in the hospitals were always fully, publicly, and accurately reported.
Cuomo says he'll have reforms involving hospitals and nursing homes in the upcoming state budget. I'm Ben Thomas.
In New Zealand, Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said the first batch of 60,000 vaccines had arrived in the country Monday. As authorities continued to investigate how a strain of a highly transmissible variant was found in three members of an Auckland family, Ardern added that the vaccine would undergo safety checks before border workers start receiving vaccinations from Saturday. In Auckland, the infections sent nearly 2 million residents into a three-day lockdown Sunday, which prompted Australia to suspend an arrangement that allowed New Zealanders to enter the country without serving a 14-day hotel quarantine period. Auckland's lockdown was the first in 6 months after a hard shutdown early in the pandemic appeared to have largely eliminated local. More at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A Nigerian is appointed WTO First Woman Director General.
I'm grateful for the trust you have in me, not just as a woman and an African, but also in my knowledge, experience, and as some of you have said, courage and passion to work with you to undertake the wide-ranging reforms the WTO needs.
DRC President Tshisekedi names the new prime minister. A trial begins today at the ICC of two Central African Republic rebel leaders. Some Namibians will protest tomorrow against plans to shut down Air Namibian operations. And some Liberians want their country's border with Guinea closed in the wake of new Ebola outbreak there.
I'm very, very afraid because Guinea and Liberia, no distance. So we are not safe. If key measures are not taken, we stand a risk to go right back to what Ebola did to Liberia. So Liberia should take this very, very seriously. I suggest that the border should even close.
A Malawi's president fires all heads of COVID-19 response funds for mismanagement. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The World Trade Organization has appointed Nigerian Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala as its next director general. Okonjo-Iweala, an economist and former Nigerian finance minister, is the first African and first woman to hold the position. Lisa Schlein reports.
Nigerian economist Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala has called her appointment as Director General of the World Trade Organization groundbreaking. She told members of the General Council that she was eager to begin the work of reforming the organization and modernizing the rules to bring them up to 21st century issues.
I'm grateful for the trust you have in me, not just as a woman and an African, but also in my knowledge, experience, and as some of you have said, courage and passion to work with you to undertake the wide-ranging reforms the WTO needs to reposition itself for the future.
Okonjo-Iweala said the challenges facing the WTO were numerous and tricky, but not insurmountable. She said one of her key priorities was to focus on the issue of COVID-19 and what the WTO could do to contribute to solutions. She said the WTO needs to work with the COVAX and ACTS Accelerator facilities, as well as with other organizations working to accelerate supplies and vaccines to poor countries.
We also encourage finding what I call a third way in which vaccines can be manufactured in many more countries whilst taking care that we don't discourage research and innovation, which is linked to intellectual property rights. So this is an area of work.
Okonjo-Iweala's selection as WTO chief was held up for many months because former President Donald Trump did not back her and refused to join the consensus regarding her candidacy. The Biden administration dropped the U.S. objection, clearing her way to getting the top job. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A member of the Democratic Republic of Congo's parliament says President Felix Tshisekedi's new prime minister was chosen because the president probably did not want to sever links with the country's Katanga province, home region of former President Joseph Kabila. President Tshisekedi on Monday appointed Jean-Michel Sama Lukonda Kienge as prime minister, replacing Kabila ally Sylvester Ilunga Ilunkamba. Lambert Mende, former information minister in the Kabila government and now a member of parliament, says Lukonde Kienge was perhaps chosen because Tshisekedi wanted to assure the people of Katanga province that his government is not their enemy. Mende says with the choice of new prime minister Lukonde Kienge, President Tshisekedi can now focus on dealing with the problems facing the country.
Mr. Jean-Michel Sama Lukonde is now, till he have been appointed the prime minister of this country, the CEO of the big mining state-owned company, Gécamines, the big mining company in Katanga. He's a former minister of youth and sports under the government of Mr. Matata some years ago before leaving that position and taking the position of the CEO of Gécamines.
What does the appointment of this new prime minister mean now in terms of President Tshisekedi going ahead to do what he was elected to do, that is doing for the people of the DRC?
Maybe President Tshisekedi did all his endeavors not to cut links with the Katanga province. That is the province of former President Kabila, with which they land in some, let me say, dispute. So he wants maybe to send a message that he does not consider Katangese as enemies. That can explain why he decided to choose somebody from Katanga, but somebody who is a former MP, a former minister, and now somebody who is was shown some capacity in dealing with the management of a big company like Gécamines, the biggest company in the Congo.
You said that President Tshisekedi now has the majority. What is the makeup now of the new parliament? How many seats does former President Kabila have?
Well, you know that President Tshisekedi said that he needs really the biggest coalition as possible. And he maintained even the door open even to Mr. Kabila and his friends to join that coalition. But we saw that more than 100 and some MPs did not follow this position of President Tshisekedi. But we have 391 MPs that have accepted, a lot of them, like me, from the Kabila's former majority. We decided that we have to give a chance to this country to take over, because we have lost a lot of times. We have many challenges to respond, the security being the one of them. I think you heard what happened yesterday in Lubumbashi, where some skirmishes occurred between the army and some people who came with guns to attack barracks of the army. So we no longer need such problems in our country. We say enough is enough. Time has come to build something for these people. So we don't consider President Kabila as our enemy. We consider him as a part of the solution of problems this country is meeting. And we have a lot of respect for Mr. Kabila due to what he did for all this country to bring in peace, to bring in alternance, and to bring in democracy.
Thank you, Mr. Mende. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
You will come, James.
Lambert Mende is former Democratic Republic of Congo's information minister and now a member of parliament. He was speaking with us from the capital, Kinshasa. In the wake of new Ebola outbreak in neighboring Guinea, some Liberians are calling on their government to close the country's border with Guinea. Rita Jilagwe reports from Monrovia.
I'm begging the government to really take care of the border.
This is the time that the government has to be vigorous, even if they were supposed to have to cross border trade.
Their government supply health center with the necessary material, because if they have worker, we control one and they will swear it.
Majority of those making the demand are from Lofa County, one of Liberia's 15 political subdivisions which borders Guinea. According to the World Health Organization, Liberia's first two confirmed cases of the 2014 Ebola outbreak were recorded in Guinea on 30 March 2014, following an Ebola outbreak in Guinea a week earlier. And Lofa recorded the highest number of confirmed cases and deaths during that period. Lopu Gefla, a social worker in Vonjama, the Lofa County capital, says she fears that if nothing is done immediately to close lined borders with Guinea, the virus might cross into Liberia.
It brings serious fear to my mind. I'm very, very afraid, because Guinea and Liberia, no distance, so we are not safe. If key measures are not taken, we stand a risk to go right back to what Ebola did to Liberia. So Liberia should take this very, very serious. I suggest that the border should even close, that people sit down by themselves. Because when we look at the current economic situation, Ebola come here, we don't know how we'll survive it.
Benora Sese, an agriculturist in Lofa, says she wants the Liberian government to halt cross-border trade with Guinea until the latest Ebola crisis subsides. She is also appealing for a boost in the country's health system.
I'm very much afraid because we know what Ebola did for the first time it came to Liberia. The people need to do something quick. A serious measure is not taken. Liberia will be swept away. Let Ebola be closed.
Contrary to the views of others, John Sumo, a resident of Lofa County who survives on cross-border trade, says closing borders with Guinea will further increase economic sufferings in Liberia.
I feel bad about this information. If it is true, the economic situation we really face with now will increase in terms of hardship because we are close to the border, and when borders are closed with Guinea, it will be a very tough time.
Meanwhile, in Maigibi County, on a highway leading to two counties bordering Guinea, Michael Freeman, a community leader, says he worries that his community will be at risk if Liberia does not close its borders with Guinea.
It is likely to spill over to Liberia. So we are urging national government to do everything possible, even if they will close the border and also beef up the security along those poorest areas, it will be good for us.
Not far from Freeman, Georgia Smith, a nurse also of Maigibi County, says the latest Ebola outbreak in Guinea will pose a serious threat to health workers in Liberia.
As I have worked here in that outbreak is now in Guinea, we are a little bit afraid. Reason being that we don't have any instrument to work with in the Vera facility, like PPEs, any medical supply we don't have.
The World Health Organization says it is already working with health authorities in Liberia and Sierra Leone to beef up community surveillance of cases in their border districts. WHO says it is also reaching out to Cote d'Ivoire, Mali, Senegal, and other countries in the sub-region whose citizens might also be at risk. Rita Jrabwe for VOA News, Liberia.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February 16th. The trial of Alfred Yeketam and Patrice Edouard Nguessona of the Central African Republic is opening today, Tuesday, at the International Criminal Court, the ICC. The two were commandos in the anti-Balaka Christian militia. They are accused of war crimes and crimes against humanity during revengeful attacks following the 2012 coup by Muslim Seleka rebels that toppled President Francois Bozizé. Elise Kepler is Associate Director of the International Justice Program at the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch. She says her organization documented hundreds of cases of rape and sexual slavery by both anti-Balaka groups and Seleka factions.
Yeketam and Nguessona are two anti-Balaka leaders, and the anti-Balaka group has been part of the conflict in the Central African Republic, which began around 2012 and has continued to some degree even through today. There was a Seleka Muslim rebel coalition that effectuated a coup in the country. And increasingly, the anti-Balaka fought the Seleka, but it was really the civilians that have borne the brunt of this conflict. By both sides, there have been horrific crimes perpetrated by the groups against civilians, attacks on civilian areas, forcible deportation, sexual violence, forcible recruitment of children. And there has been a huge justice void to address these crimes. So Yeketam and Nguessona, it's actually going to be the first trial at the International Criminal Court for anyone from the anti-Balaka to face charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity committed in this conflict.
So Elise, as you mentioned, there were horrific crimes committed. What is the role of Yeketam and Nguessona? What was their role in these crimes?
Yeah. So Nguessona was the self-declared political coordinator of the group, and Yeketam was a commander in the anti-Balaka. So both kind of high-level positions, you know, senior commander and political coordinator of the anti-Balaka. Now, you had also asked, what's the connection with the current situation? And while there's a peacekeeping force on the ground, there has been more stability in recent years. There have been more recent elections. A big portion of the country has still been under the control of armed groups, and there have been splintering groups. So it's no longer just the Seleka and the anti-Balaka, but various splinter groups. And what we saw around the most recent presidential election at the end of December was that a new coalition of some of these groups formed and began some very serious attacks on civilians and were threatening to come to the capital of Bangui again. And so from our perspective, this trial is so important, even today, as we see there are continued abuses against civilians, to send a signal that perpetrators may well find themselves before the reach of the law, and that these crimes should not and will not be tolerated.
Why are they being tried at the International Criminal Court? And because my understanding is that there is a special criminal court that was established in the Central African Republic. Why are they not being tried in the Central African Republic?
Great question. So the Central African Republic authorities asked the International Criminal Court to open an investigation, reflecting their position that they didn't have the capacity to deal with higher level cases. Now, since then, the Central African Republic has also established a court in the capital that has some international judges and prosecutors to assist the Central African experts in trying some of the crimes. But what we so often see in these most difficult cases with these most serious crimes is that it's very hard for the local authorities to deal with these kinds of cases.
Elise, thank you. It's always nice to speak with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Take good care.
Elise Kepler is the Associate Director of the International Justice Program at the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch. She was speaking with us from New York. The National Association of Namibian Workers is calling on its members and the public to participate in a mass protest this Wednesday. Demonstrators will be marching against a government decision to immediately cease all Air Namibia operations. Jaap Monnierow, the Secretary General of the Association, says the Minister for Public Enterprise, Leon Juste, and the leadership of the national carrier should be fired or forced to resign to help pave the way for Air Namibia to be rescued.
Here in Namibia, we are going to have a mass demonstration on Wednesday that is going to call for the immediate reverse of the liquidation of the airline and also for the immediate removal of the minister concerned.
But the decision was taken at the cabinet level. It wasn't the sole decision of the minister, is it?
It was a sole decision of the minister because the minister had not followed procedures because he has never consulted the committee on cabinet related to this thing. He just brought this to cabinet and tried to have a bad influence in that. Neither did not consult the procedure of consulting my office in terms of the arrangement that was in place.
The objective, as I understand, of this mass rally or demonstration is to protest against the liquidation of the national airline Air Namibia. But do you think your demonstration would have any significant impact in the rescuing attempt that you seek?
That will have definitely, because we are saying this is not for someone to decide on the national airline to be liquidated in the interest of promoting another type of business. So therefore, our call is genuine, is truthful, is business-oriented.
Are you going to follow COVID-19 protocol? Because you understand that the whole Southern African region is battling the spread of the new variant of the coronavirus. And people are expressing concern that this demonstration could help endanger the lives of Namibians. What do you say to that?
It might be true, but it is a very unfortunate situation where you have to take a risk in terms of that. Both are risky. Who is not going to die when he's hungry? You will die when you are hungry. You will also die when you get COVID. They are both COVID. So unemployment is a risk. It's a very high risk because when you are employed, at least you can have finance yourself to fight COVID. How do you fight COVID if you are unemployed? How do you rescue yourself from being strong to boost yourself in terms of COVID immune?
So I understand the government has put in measures to fight the disease, and calling for this mass demonstration will flout or sharply go against the medical advice of the health authorities in Namibia.
We are going to demonstrate. We are not going to back. We are not going to reverse our demonstration. and we are going to go against the COVID regulations, because by respecting COVID regulations, we are respecting our unemployment or our job losses. So I have no respect for anybody who wants workers to go jobless. Therefore, that risk is a risk that comes with COVID. And as far as I know, we as a country must learn to be honest and genuine and thought about the consequences that might come if that type of decisions are taken. For me, I would say it's a very irresponsible decision.
Jaap Monero is the Secretary General of the National Association of Namibian Workers. You're speaking with VOA's Peter Clotte from Windhoek. Malawi's President Lazarus Chakwera has fired all heads of COVID-19 response funds for mismanagement of money meant for dealing with the pandemic. Chakwera said over the weekend that despite Malawi's struggle to stop its surge in the virus, officials spent millions of dollars on allowances for themselves. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
In a televised address Sunday, President Chakwera said he was outraged with the alleged abuse of $8 million he allocated in August for tackling the pandemic. Malawi's Office of the Ombudsman said more than half of the money was spent on food, travel, and accommodations for the members of various task forces. Chakwera said he had fired the heads of several entities responsible for managing COVID-19 funds after they failed to account for how the funds were used.
All cluster heads, with the exception of one, submitted reports with no backing documents and had to be told on site to bring backing documents. Mind you, these are reports of money that was mostly spent last year, whose backing documents ought to have been maintained regularly, and yet cluster heads appeared before my task force showing clear signs of negligence.
Chakwera also announced the country will this week receive 100,000 additional AstraZeneca coronavirus vaccines secured through the African Union for the protection of health workers. He said this consignment for health workers is different from the 1.5 million doses arriving at the end of the month for the general public.
They put their lives at risk to save lives every day, and they share in the devastation we feel from losing loved ones to this virus, including the 100 people who have died of COVID-19 this past week. May their souls rest in peace.
Malawi has so far registered 29,035 confirmed cases of COVID-19, with 952 deaths since the first three cases were reported in April of last year.
COVID-19 death is tragic and to be mourned. And although it is God who ultimately has power over life and death, the deaths that are preventable are even more heartbreaking. We therefore have a moral and civic duty to do everything we can do to ensure that no penny meant for saving lives is stolen or abused or wasted by anybody.
The president said this is the reason he is pushing for accountability in the funds meant to fight the pandemic. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
And that's it for this Tuesday, February 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation. Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA. The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories
stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 22:30 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.